The Lopez Show Book Club is two-thirds of its way through a reading of James Joyce's Ulysses, one of the most revered and formidable masterpieces of the English language, and it's been a rewarding, although sometimes difficult, journey for many of us. Joining us now for the last on-air segment devoted to the novel are Michael Grodin, Distinguished University Professor Emeritus at Western University and author of Ulysses in Focus, and Colin McCann, author of 9 works of fiction, including Transatlantic and Let the Great World Spin, most recently a book of advice called Letters to a Young Writer. I'm very pleased to welcome both of you back to our show.
Thank you.
Now, this is a pretty esoteric and often misunderstood book. Do you think that Joyce would be pleased with my selection of guests now for this last segment on Ulysses? I have an Irish author and a Joyce scholar.
Be very displeased to have me on here talking
really?
About him. Yeah, yeah.
Why?
No, I think Joyce said that it would be studied for how many hundred years?
Centuries.
Centuries, yeah. And the scholars would quarrel and quibble, and writers would get in and poke around, and hopefully then they would become almost like magpies, taking a little bit here, taking a little bit there, and building their own nest out of this great work of imagination.
And he'd be happy with me because I am a professor who's, you know, been reading it over and over again. He said he wanted an ideal reader suffering from an ideal insomnia, and that he'd be unhappy with because I slept well last night. But and we do keep picking over the book. We don't really quarrel over it all that much anymore. I mean, in the early days, there was a lot of debate over, you know, whether Leopold Bloom was a satirical figure or a heroic figure. Those aren't really much of a problem anymore. But there's a lot of ways people talk about Ulysses, but not really quarreling about it.
Joyce is an innovator in terms of language and a virtuoso in terms of form, but without some profound human connection, this novel would not resonate with people. Yet it's been a powerful influence on many people's lives.
Certainly on mine.
Do you think that Joyce was actually trying to change the language to some degree? Was this an Irish revenge for the English imposition of English on the Irish people?
I wouldn't quarrel with that idea. I think he was highly conscious that our language, the Irish language, had been taken away from us, and he was putting English on a Gaelic Hiberno and then a world loom, and weaving things differently. But it's, you know, it's a book that's funny and smart and full. It goes just about everywhere. It's sad, honest, heroic, anti-heroic. And I think he was quite conscious of what he was doing and what he wanted to do for it to become basically a vast compendium of human experience, all stuffed into one day.
And I don't think he thought about English as a foreign language, but I don't think he thought about it as his native language. There is a place in The Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man where he's talking to an English priest who's teaching at his school. And he says that when the priest says a sort of obscure English word, that language is his before it's mine. Mm, or Stephen Dedalus says that. And I think partly that must have been, I mean, Joyce obviously had the sense that English was a tool that he would explore and use in every possible way he could, including ways people hadn't used before.
Well, couldn't he have written it in Gaelic?
No.
No, but should we read it to some degree as we might read poetry, at least sections of it?
Well, it does get read as carefully and as closely as poetry. Ezra Pound famously said when he read parts of Joyce's works that English poetry should be at least as well written as prose, right. And he had Joyce's works in mind for that.
Yeah, it's so beautiful when you hear it. I mean, reading Finnegan's Wake is like reading jazz, but reading Ulysses is like an extended symphony, and you get into it. There is a very conscious symphonic intent going on, and these different movements that are going. But if you hear, say, for example, Molly's soliloquy being read by a great actress like Aideen Maloney, the daughter of the Paddy Maloney from The Chieftains. She captures the most incredible music in a Dublin accent, but it becomes then universal, and it's naughty, and it's fun, and it's obscene, and fantastic, and celebratory.
And we encourage our listeners to listen to audiobook versions of it. Is it easier to understand when you listen to it?
I have, you know, the passage that got the book banned when Leopold Bloom leans back, or when Gertie McDowell leans back and Leopold Bloom watches her and masturbates. I occasionally run across readers who don't see what's happening or don't find it very funny. But there's a reader in Toronto, I've only heard her read it live, who does an equivalent thing to what Colin was mentioning, gives it the most incredible both intensity and passion and humor and the Irish voice. And there's no I've never been able to read that privately in a way that she did it aloud.
Colin, is it assumed that every aspiring writer in Ireland will read Ulysses at some point or another?
Unfortunately not. You know, when I was growing up, Joyce wasn't around. I wasn't taught Joyce in school. In fact, Joyce wasn't even mentioned.
Not even the easier books?
Not even the easier books, not even the short stories, not Dubliners.
Portrait of the Artist.
People were ashamed of Joyce. I'm talking about the early 1970s. It wasn't until the late 70s, as Michael has said before on the show and in the 80s, that Joyce sort of got a new lease of life. Before that, there was not a single statue around. They would take the doors off 7 Eccles Street. They would destroy the literary landmarks that are there. You can't go to Dublin now without seeing Joyce just about everywhere.
I was rather indiscreet in an earlier discussion of the book, talking about something that I said that you had told me about Irish writers' thoughts about Ulysses. I think I should apologize to you.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say so. It's interesting because things get attributed to certain writers, and the statement was that most Irish writers feel that Ulysses is useless.
Well, they called it useless. Somebody told me that. I associated it with you.
It must have been another column, man, not Colm Tibbean. But the thing about it is, there are certain people who feel that they don't need to read it, and you're correct in that sense. But what they don't realize is, even if they haven't read it, they actually have read it, because Ulysses is so important to the shakedown of the language.
Does it matter when you come to it, Michael? How old were you when you first read it?
I was 19.
And you read it straight through?
Yeah, but it was in a university class, so yes. It does matter. One of the things I found that intrigues me is that I have never, over all the times that I've read it, been able to think of Leopold Bloom as anything other than a father figure quite a bit older than me, even though now he's like 35 years younger than me. And when I teach it to adults especially, sometimes some of the people in my classes have read it before and either loved it or hated it or were bewildered by it. And when they're reading it now, they're readjusting their place in relation to it. Others are reading it for the first time, so of course they see Leopold Bloom either as a contemporary of theirs or younger than them. And it's fascinating to watch it. I think in a case of this kind of book, where there's really no progression in time, it really does matter when you first read it. It doesn't mean it might matter in terms of your ability to appreciate it or your ability to like it or hate it.
Is Leopold Bloom the human heart of the story?
Oh, for me, yes.
And you're nodding your head, Colin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he is the focus of just about everything. And what Michael is talking so beautifully about is that literature it can actually allow us to become alive in these bodies and times that are not our own. And I think of all the books of the 20th century, Ulysses does that in the most profound way, so that I can feel myself to be Bloom, but I could also feel in an act of sort of radical imagination and a shotgun leap into Molly's head and Molly's consciousness at the end of the novel.
Didn't you read the book straight through when you were stuck in a hospital bed?
I was stuck in a hospital bed.
You tried it earlier?
Yeah, I had tried it earlier and had gone through it in different bits and pieces. But I was on lots of Percocet. Maybe that helped. And I read it all the way through. And what happened to me then was that my grandfather, who I had only met once in my life, became acutely alive for me. So that in the act of Joyce's creation in his imagination, he actually allowed me access to the reality of my grandfather, which I think is a really profound thing that literature can do for us.
And it, Michael, you talked about at one point perhaps writing a memoir that was about your relationship with this novel.
I have written it. And I got really interested in why this book hit me so incredibly hard when I was 19, when I was totally unprepared for it. I mean, I had no idea really what the book even was. And when Colum said things like he wrote at one point, it allows us to become the other we never dreamed we could be, which I loved as a statement. In one sense, Ulysses allowed me to become the person that I already could have been or was, but had no idea that I was. I had a very little imagination when I was a child, and even as an English major in college, and had a very closed off kind of mind. And I understand why now. I mean, I lived in an environment where people stopped talking to each other for no reason at all, and it became dangerous to perhaps do something that could cause a cutoff. And suddenly I'm reading this book with this detailed picture of a mind that has no restraints, that's completely uncensored. And it took me about 25 years to kind of grow into that mind.
And Colum, you've said that in Joyce we're always meeting ourselves.
Mm. Yeah. I think, you know, when we get in there and we uncover what these characters are doing and what this city, which is really a universal city, it's Dublin, very specifically Dublin, but it becomes a universal city, we can wander around inside it and begin to understand things about who we are and our relationship to the world, which is what the best poetry, prose will always do.
Now, he's writing about Dublin while in exile. So is this the real Dublin, or is this the fantasy Dublin of James Joyce?
It's probably a combination of the two of those. He did have an incredible memory.
Right. He said we should be able to recreate Dublin from the book.
You can recreate certain things. I was astonished when I first visited Dublin that I had no idea what any of the buildings he was writing about looked like. So they were all a big surprise to me. And of course, there's very little visual description of those buildings in the book.
There's a great line in there about good puzzle to cross Dublin without passing a pub. So I remember in the 1980s with a few of my friends when we were a little bit overserved, we decided if we could walk through the city centre of Dublin without passing a pub, it was impossible.
Except in the
park. Colum, you don't live in exile, but right. You are an expat.
Yeah.
Does that resonate for you?
Yeah, it brings me back. I mean, there are certain elements of nostalgia when you sort of are away from your hometown. So it resonates for me indeed. But more, Joyce resonates in a much more global way for me increasingly as time goes on. It seems to me that people are really getting involved. I love the fact that you have it on your show as the book pick, but also Bloomsday is such a big day now. It's kind of like we call it the thinking man's St. Patrick's Day. And there's all sorts of great celebrations go on.
We have to take a little break and we'll come back with my guests, Colum McCann and Michael Groden. We're talking about James Joyce's Ulysses. This is the last of three segments devoted to it. We hope that many of our listeners have been reading along with us, and we'll continue after this. And we are back with our discussion of James Joyce's Ulysses, the last of a three-part series on the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. My guests are Colum McCann, author of 9 works of fiction, including Transatlantic, Let the Great World Spin. Most recently, he was a guest on our show to talk about his book of advice to young writers called Letters to a Young Writer. And Michael Groden, distinguished university professor emeritus at Western University, the author of Ulysses in Focus. How much of this is a meditation on the novel? Because he takes us from Chaucer through Dickens and further in one chapter. Is he talking about a lot more than just the story of these three or four major characters?
I think when he started out to write a modern epic, he originally started to write a story that would be sort of equivalent to the Odyssey in a middle class modern times. I think as he went on into writing the book, he started to want epic to mean every possible way you could tell a story. Mm-hmm. And so that each of those later chapters, it's as if Leopold Bloom and those characters are in a different kind of, completely different kind of story. And then in the one chapter, the one called Oxen of the Sun that you're referring to, he's in every story. You know, he's in every story from Beowulf up to the late 19th century. And I think one of the things Joyce, whether he wanted to do it or did do it, is to show that this simple little story that Leopold Bloom is part of can be told in every way you could imagine telling a story.
Well, is he celebrating the history of English literature or warning us that he's planning to transform it?
Probably the second more than the first.
Probably a little bit of both, actually. Yeah, right? Yeah.
Colin, I mentioned that your last book was a book of advice to young writers. If Joyce were to write such a book, have you ever thought about what kind of advice he would give?
Well, I mean, I have a single chapter in the book that just says rejoice, and it's rejoyce, and then it's also rejoice. I think he would want people to rejoice in the language. I think he would want people to stretch themselves more. I think he would believe in the excellence of difficulty. And I think he would triumph the fact that people were still trying to stretch out from the novel that he created. I mean, Ulysses is the most marvelous rattlebag of ideas and words and everything just sort of like thrown together in this marvelous concoction. But he was entirely aware of everything that he was doing, and little moments in each chapter tracking other moments, a cloud in one chapter reflected in the next chapter, and everything very symmetrical and mathematical and fascinating.
Did he believe each story was actually many stories depending on who was telling it?
I think he would believe that.
Michael, why did Joyce choose to make Bloom a Jew, or is he really a Jew because his mother wasn't Jewish?
I think he wanted an outsider. I think he wanted somebody that other Dubliners would not see as one of them.
Because he felt like he was an outsider?
Well, no. I think it had more to do with... he was kind of wrapped up in his own story and telling Stephen Dedalus' story. And then I think tried to find some way of telling a story that was completely outside of that. And possibly it's because he knew a lot of assimilated Jewish men in Trieste and probably got
including his famous student, Italo Svevo,
yeah,
who wrote a great novel.
Yeah.
Right.
And Confessions of Zeno, or whatever they call it now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that idea of the outsider, you know, which lets him talk about everything from a perspective of somebody who isn't part of the group that he's in, and everybody sees him as different from them. The bigotry and the prejudice and anti-Semitism that comes out over and over again. It could have happened with any sort of non-traditional Irish person, but I think he chose a Jewish man. Probably the reason he
must have known that he wasn't Jewish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I suspect he did that because Joyce himself didn't really know that much about Jewish culture and Judaism. And
or he might be saying that the Irish are actually the lost tribe.
Yeah. I think.
Well, did he see the Irish as outsiders, as oppressed people?
Well, they were at that particular stage. They were oppressed by the church, oppressed from within, oppressed from without, as well. And you know, he had to get away in order to look back and to have a clarity there. And I think that part of what Joyce was doing was he was stretching his wings. He was bringing Ireland out and away from itself. He no longer wanted it to be looking in the cracked looking glass of itself. He wanted to expand the notion of Irishness. And let's face it, Joyce was one of the great globalists. And when you get to Finnegan's Wake and you see what he's doing with language there, He believes in sort of expanding outside the limits of nationalism.
Do you think he expected anybody to read that book all the way through?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I never got past the first two paragraphs.
I think he thought he was going to write a bestseller that was would be read, you know, as if it were Jane Austen.
And it is read, though. I mean, this is the thing. People gather in Switzerland and have been doing so for years and years and years to examine a page every single day. And people, and the same with with Ulysses. I mean, it's really quite fantastic.
Well, are you doing something similar, Colm, when you include stories of Africans and African Americans in your books?
Well, I would hope that my job is to expand a sense of Irishness, and that one story sort of becomes all stories. And I'm interested. My novels sort of operate in different territories. I've written about a gay Russian ballet dancer. I've written about a gypsy woman. I've written about Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker. And I write towards my obsessions. And those obsessions at this particular stage happen to be global. But I know that I would never be able to write what I have written without having read someone like James Joyce.
And as I mentioned earlier, you wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times about Ulysses. The title was "But Always Meeting Ourselves."
Right.
Who was your grandfather, and what contact had you had with him before he died? Because you write about him in that piece.
Yeah, see, the fascinating thing was my grandfather, frankly, I can say this now because my father is passed away 2 years ago. My grandfather was a drunk. He lived in London. I got to meet him one time in a nursing home. I went up the stairs, and when I walked in the door, he's there, and he says, "Ah, another effing McCann." He sat me up on the bed, and he began to tell me stories about his life, and I couldn't really ever fully visualize his life until 40 years later when I properly read Ulysses, and I rediscovered that old man. And it was such a beautiful moment to acknowledge that it wasn't really me that met my grandfather, but somehow James Joyce had met my grandfather. And therefore, we're always meeting ourselves.
Michael, Edna O'Brien said on the show that she was particularly suited to reading Ulysses because she was a naturally slow reader. Does Ulysses make slow readers of us all?
In one sense, sure, because the more you can take the time to savor it, the richer it's going to be. I mean, some of it reads quite quickly, but a lot of it certainly doesn't. And the way that the thoughts come out and the way that the lives slowly unfold. I mean, it takes 26 or 28 hours to read it at a normal pace, and that's a lot longer than it takes to live it.
You have favorite chapters?
For me, yeah, but they're probably the ones that I've worked the most on. I mean, they're not necessarily the ones that are... I mean, the newspaper one called Aeolus, the Cyclops one, which a lot of people find their favorite one. It's the one in the bar where all the men are... It's the most viciously anti-Semitic chapter in the book, but it's also probably the funniest chapter in the book.
We should point out that it's not called Ulysses for nothing. It's, on some level, it also refers back to Homer's Odyssey. Are celebrations like Bloomsday good ways for people to get involved with Ulysses?
I love it. I mean, every year we gather down on Stone Street, as I said, and we get a couple of hundred people in various states of Victorian dress and undress and redress and whatever other form of dress, and everyone sits outside and they have a few pints and they drink some burgundy and we toast a book that has changed our lives.
And you tend to read the Citizen chapter.
I read the Citizen chapter, yeah, because, well, first of all, because Aideen Maloney reads my favorite chapter, which is Penelope, and a man shouldn't read the Penelope chapter anyway. And I like the section where Bloom says, you know, I am Irish. I was born here, Ireland. So it's confronting the notions of his Jewishness, confronting the notions of his Irishness. You know, where is a man from? And what is it that makes an attachment to place? And that's particularly important for me.
And in Toronto, the organizers of an event found a water tower at the end of one of the streetcar lines on the lake, and that becomes the Martello Tower, and there's a house numbered 7 right at the end of a street at the lake, and they do a Bloomsday walk, recreating Dublin on these streets of one end of Toronto.
Isn't there one in Dublin?
Oh, there's.
Have you attended?
I've been in Dublin on Bloomsday and walked along the Strand, and it's very funny. There's a great one here in New York as well, in Symphony Space, that was been going for many, many years, and attracts all sorts of fabulous actors.
Well, my great thanks to both of you for being on our show, Colm McCann and Michael Groden. We've been talking about James Joyce's Ulysses. This is the last of a 3-part series on it, but we will not ignore Bloomsday.
No, don't do that.
And
fantastic.
What a pleasure it's been having you here.
Oh, thank you.